The Constitutional Convention and Federalist Papers was presented by Charlie Dewberry at Gutenberg College's 2010 Summer Institute entitled Democracy, a User's Manual. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, I want to come back and start talking, flesh out a couple things I started talking about this morning, for one thing. Secondly, I want to start with the Constitutional Convention, just to sort of put the context together. More specifically, and then we'll look at the Federalist Papers in general and Federalist 10 and 51, and then I'll make a few comments linking it with some of the things that Jack had said yesterday. So that's my goal here in the next period of time. So first, I'll start with the Constitutional Convention, and remember that actually wasn't what it was called at the time, exactly. Under the Articles of Confederation, it had been clear for several years that the system wasn't working very well. And there was a convention called the Annapolis Convention held previous to the Constitutional Convention, which basically said we need to have some fairly significant look at the structure of our Articles of Confederation, and we need to propose some pretty significant amendments to it. That was actually the mandate given to the Constitutional Convention. 1787 was the convention in the summer, or the Annapolis one was about 6 months to a year before that. I don't remember. Anybody remember exactly how far? So anyway, the Constitutional Convention, 55 delegates from 12 of the states. I can't tell you the one state that didn't show up. I tried to find it last night and couldn't find it quick enough. Anybody know that? Oh, what's that? okay. a number of people came and went. As I mentioned, the New York delegation was a classic case of people who came and went. But on the last day, there were 42 people present, and all but three of them signed the document. Now, the challenges. And first, they all knew at the convention that they actually had done something that they weren't given the authority to do. They were well aware of that. The mandate they'd been given was vague, but ratification was the key issue. And actually, there were two issues. Ratification was one. But the more I read, I have come to the conclusion that the myth of George Washington is maybe not a myth. The status he had, the fact that he attended the convention and was there most of the time, legitimized it. I think there's no denying that he had that kind of stature at the time. So in part, I think that was a large part of legitimizing the process, because there were a large number of people who just wanted to name him king and have it done with. So anyway, that was part of it. But as I mentioned this morning, there was the issue of ratification. Under the Articles of Confederation, every state had to ratify it. And under the proposed new constitution, only nine of them did. Um, So the specific problem was that under the Constitution, it had, when they got done writing it, they said, okay, we're sending it to the states. The states need to ratify it, but only 9 of them do. And if 9 of them do, then it's binding. Now, a piece that's interesting, backing up and part of context, the Constitutional Convention that drafted the Articles of Confederation, it's interesting, they weren't given the mandate to do that either. They drafted a constitution, but had never been given the mandate to draft a constitution. They did it because it needed to get done. Secondly, the Constitutional Congress did draft the Declaration of Independence, but they never sent it out for anybody to ratify it, and nobody voted on it. So there are some really interesting issues about how things are working during this period of time, how things are getting done. And so it isn't out of the context for this to have happened, given the context of what's already happened. So I think it's fairly evident that a lot of people are flying by the seat of their pants here and just getting done what needs to get done. So the challenge before the convention, really, they came to the conclusion that they desired to preserve liberty and to achieve the common good by establishing a republic. And there was a second problem. And the core problem was, as they looked at history, all republics throughout history collapsed into anarchy or tyranny. So a precondition for a successful republic, they decided, and actually this was John Adams's chief thing he brought to it, is why did they think they could succeed? And there were two reasons for this. One, because of the science of the Enlightenment and new understanding of political theory, they now had more scientific principles to build a government than the earlier governments had. And I'll talk about some of those principles in a minute. But secondly, what Adams highlighted was this must be a virtuous republic. That in the end, the only thing that will make this successful where all of the rest failed is basically a religious or moral foundation to it. If that's lost, we're going to just be another republic, you know, that came and went. So it's John Adams who made that point first. But as I mentioned earlier, Madison wrote most of the Constitution through the convention, and he basically agreed with Adams's assessment. That's the foundation to making it successful. So there's tension here. On one hand, you need some kind of central government. Anarchy isn't going to work. But yet, on the other hand, how are you going to safeguard the freedom of individuals? That's the tension. And again, they decided that a republic, and a virtuous republic, as they called it, is the best possible solution to this problem. And that's what they tried to frame. That essentially was their framework then that they brought to try to structure the Constitution in order to accomplish that. I'm not going to talk about the specifics of the Constitution. I don't have time to do that. I mean, I think we're aware of most of the basic structure of it, and we'll touch on later on some of the more important parts, but I'm going to skip over that portion of it. And then bring us back to what I talked about this morning. So now the Constitutional Convention has happened. It's occurred. And back to the issue of the challenge that Governor Clinton from New York had basically laid down. First, he pointed out they didn't have a mandate to do this. Secondly, Montesquieu tells us that any large republic is destined to fail. So your leading guru of political theory is basically telling you this is a formula for disaster. So that's a problem in New York. He's a very popular governor. And he is dead set against the Constitution. And you want to get it ratified, as I say, just because of the problem here of legitimizing this Constitution that nobody had authorized anybody actually to do. So that brings us to the Federalist Papers, as I mentioned, authored by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. And first, I'll just make a few general comments about the Federalist Papers. They're really unique in political theory. I mean, they don't start out talking about the origin of government or any of that kind of stuff. And it's actually a template of government rather than a true philosophical work about government. And what's really interesting to me, the more I look at this, what's really interesting is what's not here. So, for example, when you read political theory and then look at history, and I'm just going to back up a few years, most of the issues that caused England and France and most of the European countries to end up with revolutions to sort out this kind of thing, they were never ever mentioned or even debated in the American context. Things like monarchs, succession, nobility, the role of the nobility, relationship of church and state, no discussion on the origin or purpose of government, and one that comes up in the discussion of Federalist 10, common good. No discussion about any of those things. I find that incredibly striking, because all the rest of the countries ended up in revolution over those sorts of things. So my conclusion is one of two things. One, in general, there was sort of an agreement on those things, or there was an agreement that we're not going to have a discussion about those things because that's going to end this party. So I don't know at this point how it all sorts out, but it's just very interesting that some of those could have been a deal breaker, it seems to me. Common good could have been a deal breaker, because in different states, certain things are really important to them. And if you start articulating what those are, some of them are mutually exclusive, like tariffs, no tariffs, slavery, yes, no. I mean, if we start going down the list here, you don't go very far before this thing's dead on arrival. So there is this issue of what is it that really is held in common and what is it that we've really decided we're not going to talk about at this point because it would be a deal killer. A good example here was the Bill of Rights. No Bill of Rights in the original Constitution. Why not? Well, Madison tells us explicitly, what sense does it make to write a Bill of Rights when the people are the government? You write a Bill of Rights, all you're doing is limiting yourself. You're limiting yourself to a laundry list. Why would you want a Bill of Rights in this kind of government? 2 weeks later, he writes a Bill of Rights because New York wants a Bill of Rights because there isn't any Bill of Rights in here, so we don't have any guarantees that we have any rights. So he turns around and writes it. Why? It's necessary if we're going to ratify this thing. So according to the Federalist Papers, what's the nature of the problem here? The first problem is the danger of disunion, and that's the focus of them all. That's how Madison and Hamilton, who have basically as diametrically opposed views of political theory and the nature of human beings, it probably can exist, why they can work on this project together. Because if it doesn't pass, they conclude that it's the end of this party. Secondly, is the advantages of a strong union. Third, outlining the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation. Then they outline the nature of the proposed government, its powers, its relationship to states, and the protections it provides against the dangerous use of power. Those are basically the issues that the Federalists are going to argue why the proposed Constitution should be ratified by the state of New York. So in Federalist number one, it basically outlines specifically, that's their goal. This is a series of papers to convince you New York residents that you need to pass this thing. And at the time, Federalist number one was published, no state had yet ratified the Constitution. It hadn't been very long. It was finished in the summer. I think it was early September. The first Federalist paper came out in late October, so it's only been a month, so no one really would have had time. But they have no idea how this thing is going to go down. So when Federalist number one was essentially written, no state had ratified it as of yet. So as I said, the objective was to create a republic that was going to last. And as I remarked this morning, Hamilton had written number nine and had given his case for why Montesquieu was wrong. Okay, so now that brings us to Federalist 10. And as I said, when Hamilton had organized the Federalist Papers, who was going to write them, Madison wasn't even in the first three or four possibilities. I don't know how soon he decided that Madison was a possibility, but I think certainly when he started to write number nine, he was certainly aware of the fact that wasn't an incredibly strong argument, and they really needed someone who could provide a strong argument against the theory that a republic could only be small in size and work. Madison was the obvious case to make this. He had worked in Virginia. He had written most of the state constitution of Virginia. The Virginia plan that was brought to the Constitutional Convention was in large part at least the starting point for the structure of the Constitution. His background, he was a graduate of Princeton, studied with a guy named Wetherspoon, and his interest for a number of years had been to look at all the republics throughout history and why they failed. And so he was really the individual that worked on that issue, and a number of his early Federalist papers are outlining all of the reasons they failed. And so in the end, he was by far the best choice they could have made. So Federalist 10. First, I want to start with a caution. And the caution really comes from sort of my experience with this. When I was an undergrad in the 60s, I attended a college, James Madison College. Its background, it was put together by a bunch of Rooseveltian New Deal type people who wanted to start a small college to basically provide a college education for the next generation of New Deal Democrats. The only person who did not fit that bill was a guy named George Will, who was on staff for 2 years, and then he left. But anyway, we spent a year on Federalist 10 at James Madison College. Now, I wasn't a great student in the 60s, but the more I read Federalist 10, I couldn't figure out why they called this James Madison College. Because it was also the center of the New Left, and this is where all the SDS and Weathermen and all those folks were. This was the radical college at a cow college, so how radical is that? But this was the radical part of Michigan State University, so all the radicals were in James Madison. And as I say, the more I read and heard about Federalist 10, I got sort of confused, because I wasn't a great reader of this stuff, but it was pretty clear to me he was saying something pretty different from what they were saying. So the caution is this. Starting in 1913, a guy named Charles Beard wrote a book called The Economic Interpretation of the American Constitution. And in it, he's basically arguing that you should read number 10 as Marxist determinism, meaning this is the attempt of the wealthy people in essentially America to write a document to protect their rights and their class. And so you need to read it with that in mind. And, I mean, if you just casually look, he does talk about protection of property. He is talking about, and at times he even talks about class. So, I mean, there's a certain sense of at least there are some touchstones here that might fit. But my caution is most all of the history I ever got in college or universities from the 60s on comes more out of this New Left, I would say, than from any other source. In fact, I can't think of a class I took from anyone who did not have that sort of spin to it. So, caution. Let's go slow when we hit some of these words and terms, because I think we misinterpret Madison if we plug those in. Okay, first, what is Madison actually talking about? What view does he have of kind of his paradigm example in history he wants to look at? I would argue it's not 18th century England, meaning an industrial economy that Marx is looking at. That's not what he means. That's not the form of political system he's looking at. Most all of his examples start with classical Greeks and Romans and then into medieval. So his view is not limited to just 18th century England right now in this industrial situation with these classes. Secondly, his view is clearly broader than class self-interest. Certainly, he acknowledges there are classes and they have different interests. But actually, what's interesting is in an essay he wrote on education, he was arguing that everyone should support public education. And his argument was this: there isn't any family that within two or three generations is going to find themselves in a different class. There's fluidity to these things. I mean, a family that's rich, you expand out after a few generations, there's going to be poor members of that. Some that are poor are going to become wealthy. What we need to do is back up and think about this in a broader perspective with regard to class. The perspective you have shouldn't be governed by just short-term interests. You should have a much broader perspective with regard to issues, not just class. Okay, so those are the major comments I just wanted to preface this with, because as I say, in modern ears, at least my ears from the 60s, when I hear some of these terms, property, class, I'm instantly going to have a leftish, more socialist sort of view of this, and I would say that's inappropriate from what Madison has intended here. Okay, so in Federalist 10, his proposed constitution, he's arguing that within the proposed structure, there is the ability to break and control fraction. Well, that's an interesting claim, because that's actually different from the claim that Adams would made. Adams was basically arguing that the ability to control factions, that's going to lie in the moral and the religious. That's not going to be within the political structure to do that at all. But you remember, in Federalist 9, Hamilton had to make a case that this solution gives us a solution to that problem. Government's got to have a solution to this problem. So Madison here is laying out as best he can the claim of why this proposed constitution is better at controlling or getting rid of, as we'll see, factions. So first, what is a faction? And let's take a close look at that definition. It's a number of citizens, whether a majority or a minority, that are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Okay, so it's a number of people. It can be a majority or a minority who are united by some impulse or interest that's adverse to individual citizens or to, as he puts it here, the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Other places he calls it the common good. So what would be examples of what he would consider factions? Things like creditors, debtors, religious sects, Shays' Rebellion. And that actually was huge in Hamilton's mind. Shays' Rebellion was a group of veterans from the Revolutionary War in Massachusetts were having their land confiscated by the state. They had been paid in continental dollars, paper money. And the state had passed a law that the farmers had to pay their mortgages with specie, real money, not continentals. And the state had provided no means to convert continentals. They were almost worthless. And so all these veterans of the Revolutionary War were having their land confiscated. 5,000 of them took up arms and took over a federal munitions area. And so now the issue is, what are we going to do? We got an insurrection going here in Massachusetts. And Massachusetts tried to get help from neighboring states. And New York had a debate. Should we do that or not? I don't know. I mean, Massachusetts is close. Can this spread over? What's going on here? In the end, they didn't. So nobody came to Massachusetts' help. Massachusetts called out its militia, and there was armed warfare and put for a short period of time, and then they put down the insurrection. So that was ripe, certainly, in Hamilton's mind. That occurred about 6 months prior to this. And it's certainly on Madison's mind that those kinds of things, those are factions, and those are serious. An unnamed one was slavery. They all knew that was an issue that had some serious consequences. But again, you have to be very careful about what can be done and can't be done at a point in time. So anyway, those are factions. So according to Madison here in Federalist 10, there's two methods for cure. You either remove the causes or remove the effects. So to remove the causes, you destroy liberty, or you give people the same opinions. And he made the statement that liberty is to faction as air is to fire. There's no solution there. And his second point was, as long as man is fallible, and I want to highlight the fallible, there will be differences. That man's a mixture of passions and reasons. This is, I would argue, coming from his biblical view of man. And the roots of his view are Scottish common sense philosophy. He'd studied Thomas Reid for a number of years. For those of you with a philosophical background, of course, when I was in the philosophy department, most of the department hadn't heard of Thomas Reid. So, but he has essentially become more popular in philosophy departments the last decade or so. But anyway, he was well-read and basically came from a Scottish common sense perspective in his political or in his philosophical views. And he held basically the Christian view here of man being sinful. So to Madison, faction was like a disease. There's no cure here. So the best we can do then is to minimize the effects. And so to minimize the effects, first, if it's a minority, that's a piece of cake. You just, you know, vote on it and that's done. But the problem, of course, is the issue of majority faction. Now, how can you sort of have a majority faction? And again, this comes back. If we look at our definition, it's any group, and he said minority or minority, who are opposed to basically the common good here or the rights of any citizen, or a majority that would somehow trample the rights of individual citizens. How are we essentially going to minimize the effect of that? His argument is that ultimately majority factions, there is no way to ensure that you minimize those effects. So ultimately, he did acknowledge that there is not a solution in this framework. However, you certainly can minimize in the sense of, at a point in time when impulses and emotion rise and you could essentially have a faction take over a political point of view, he wants a complex enough machinery of checks and balances that's going to take a lot of time. And over time, it minimizes the likelihood that you could have a perfect storm of those kinds of things. So his point is we want enough machinery here that stuff takes quite a long time. That in itself is going to minimize the effects of a majority faction. It's not a cure, but it's going to minimize the effects. So the point to make here is that he sees, in his view, pure democracy has absolutely no possibility of even minimizing the effect of factions. A democracy, there's nothing a democracy can do with regard to factions. But a republic, on the other hand, on one hand, it can set up this machinery that makes it complicated and makes it difficult to essentially pass or get something passed by a faction. The second one is, by electing representatives, you at least put one layer of people between this democratic whole population, this majority faction, and the possibility that it could pass and that they could make something pass and become law. You at least put this group of representatives in between. Now, what they decide to do, you know, is largely going to be dependent on what the people desire them to do, but at least you have some level of check on just what the popular persuasion is at this point. And secondly, delegates will only be elected for a short time, so there won't be this issue of their developing long-term ties, perspectives, and whatever. They can only essentially represent the people for a short period of time anyway in his perspective. And so that's going to minimize the likelihood that they would do something in the case of a faction just for political expediency. And so in large part, then, he's going to make a similar argument that Hamilton did about large republics having advantage over small republics. And again, his argument is the larger the area, the more diverse the people, and the more diverse their interest, it's much harder for a faction, a particular point of view, to essentially then gain enough power to be able to pass something at this national level. So, in Federalist 10, does he claim there is the possibility of prevention or curing factions? The answer is no. But he argues that the new framework does minimize it. Federalist 51. And in 51, he comes back, and this is largely an argument about his checks and balances and the effect that we're just setting up the machinery and splitting up the power so that no one can gain enough power to essentially pass laws against the common good. And there's the famous quote in 51, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external or internal controls of government would be necessary. So again, just classic Madison. He not only does not trust the people, he doesn't trust democracy, but he doesn't trust the people that are the government either. So there's got to be controls on both the democratic aspects here as well as government. And again, if the majority were united in a common interest that impinged on the rights of the minority, according to him, there's only two possibilities of minimizing those effects. One is to create a will independent of the majority. And I've wondered for a long time what he had in mind there, and I finally kind of landed that's constructing sort of a nobility, that you construct a group of people that sort of stand above it, an oligarchy or some kind of nobility, and that they essentially keep it from happening. But he basically says that isn't going to happen here. And so the other part is, in these large republics then, you get many categories of people with many kinds of interests, and it makes it really hard for any kind of these factions to occur. So according to Madison then, a coalition of a majority of whole society could seldom take place on any principle other than justice and general good in a republic that's large. So now I'd like to make just a couple comments with regard to the constitutional structure that was put together, make a couple comments with regards to that, comparing it with the criteria that Jack proposed yesterday for the proper form of government. And those were three: to create space to allow individuals to find belief, that the government should not force or coerce, and there should be freedom to pursue belief. I would argue that the proposed framework meets those three criteria reasonably well. In summary, no one saw this proposed framework as a ultimate solution to this problem. They all viewed it as a compromise. Both Hamilton and Madison both viewed the proposed document as really inadequate and not likely to succeed because it was too weak. But yet, on the other hand, most of the public was arguing that even the structure that was put together was far too strong and rejected and infringed on their freedoms to a much larger degree than they thought acceptable. Madison, essentially, in Federalist 10, has framed an answer to the issue of factions and basically said the structure doesn't cure the problem. The problem lies ultimately within the nature of man. No government's going to cure that. All we can do is minimize the effects. And this document does a reasonable job of minimizing the effects as best we can. But ultimately, in a republic, that's not possible with an internal structure of government. And so Madison ultimately would agree with Adams that the only way to essentially guarantee that factions do not trample the rights of individuals or the common good is based on moral and religious virtue. And lastly, just a comment that again, it's very interesting to look at these documents and see, one, what isn't talked about, and then to recognize how several and many of the crucial terms that would be very interesting to have a clear definition of what they had in mind. Usually, quite often, that's going to be lacking here, either because of political expediency, recognizing that if they didn't get this passed, the project was over, or just essentially not wanting to get into those kind of issues at this point in time. In the end, all 13 colonies did ratify the Constitution. It took New York twice. They did not ratify it the first time. It passed like 32 to 31 with 36 proposed amendments. I don't know what that meant and how it got worked out. But anyway, it passed. The last state to ratify it was Rhode Island, and their vote was by one again between it, and they proposed like 15 amendments. So it was not an easy process. It was a really messy process. And the Federalist Papers represent a unique and a really unique piece within political philosophy. And the foundation of it really represents on their realistic view of the nature of man and the challenges of government. So that's it. Questions?